Hi guys, welcome to another episode of the Perth Fit Fam podcast and episode number 44. We are catching up with Alex Thomas and Kyle Weber from Sports Nutrition Australia before they come to Perth for their bodybuilding and comp prep workshop. So in this podcast, we talk all things industry related with sports nutrition regulations and what to look out for and the qualifications required if you're either a practicing sports nutritionist, if you'd like to give out nutrition advice, or even if you're a consumer who is receiving nutrition advice across the board from any of your trainers. And as always, the Perth Fit Fam podcast is brought to you by True Protein. True is unafraid to cut through the noise of an oversaturated market and break the mold to deliver authentic, all-natural products with genuine health benefits and none of the fake stuff. True have bucked the trend for expensive, overhyped, bad-tasting protein powders and supplements packed with false promises to reinvent the marketplace and create a 100% natural, delicious, quality protein and supplement line with no gimmicks, nothing artificial, and a completely transparent ingredient list. You can pick up True Protein online at trueprotein.com.au, and if you use the code PerthFitFam10, you'll get an exclusive PerthFitFam discount. And if you are located in WA and you want to pick up some product locally, we have over 120 retailers and resellers. And if you want to find the one closest for you, just get in contact and we'll help you out. That is trueprotein.com.au with the code PerthFitFam10. That is all for our sponsors. So here we go, episode 44 with Alex Thomas and Kyle Weber of Sports Nutrition Australia. I hope you guys enjoy. Leaked us in. Let's jump straight into it. So I think this is going to be episode 44 from memory. I hope I'm right. Otherwise, I'm going to have to re-edit that. But we have Alex and Kyle, the boys from Sports Nutrition Australia on, who will be coming to Perth shortly, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But boys, welcome on to the Perth Fit Fam podcast.
Thanks for having us, Brendan.
Thanks, Brendan.
So first of all, I know that we had a chat on the phone last week and you guys had a really rad story just about Sports Nutrition Australia and how things got kicked off. So give the guys a bit of context into what Sports Nutrition Australia is and how you guys got started.
I guess I'll sort of take the lead on that one. So basically, it was about 5.5 years ago. I had a training and allied health center that I own and operated, and we've got cameos of Bane at the moment, Kyle.
Yeah, the dog's in the background. He's gonna go bonkers.
Yeah. We've got Bane, Kyle's cat, and then my dog's just chilling here.
Well, I should probably like throw out a disclaimer. I've got Alice Rounds, two dogs staying with us. They're in Bali. So the dogs are staying with us. And so if we hear some dogs yapping halfway through, we'll thank Alice Round for that one.
That's awesome. Thanks, Alice. Yeah, so
great job, Randy.
About 5.5 years ago, I was only operating this training and allied health center. So we had like PTs, ex-physios, dietitians, ex-scientists, all this kind of stuff. And I was like, look, I know everyone's chatting about nutrition and stuff. I want to, now that it's sort of my neck on the chopping block, right? Like we were talking about, everyone's like, oh, it's a proprietary limited company. You're not liable or there's less liability and stuff. And like, as we all know, if you're a director, you're liable. So, I was talking to the insurers and stuff and I was like, look, I really don't want to be liable for any of these conversations that these people are having. And they're like, look, they need to have like an adequate scope of practice. You need to have a really good level of cover for this stuff. That's sort of the only way that you can offset any of that risk. And I was like, look, there's a couple of these programs that were floating around at the time that were sort of claiming, hey, look, we can do bodybuilding, we can do all this kind of stuff. But as we sort of pull back the layers, and especially like within the insurance world, the guy at the time who happened to be a broker of mine was also, he sat on boards and underwrote a bunch of fitness industry stuff. And he was like, look, don't touch those with a 10-foot pole. They're I wouldn't put my house on it or anything like that. Like typically, again, in these business situations, you'd be like setting up with a lease and then you'd say, hey, look, I own a property and all this kind of stuff. And so, yeah, you know, they'd say that stuff. And if you don't have property, they'd say, look, well, how much money's in the bank and all that kind of stuff. So you have to, you know, be privy and provide all this information through these processes anyway. And so long story short, I was like, well, I'd been doing some undergrad study and like mucking around in undergrads for a while and wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And I'd looked at I'd been involved with like what was HM back in the day, human movements. And looked at the dietetics program as well and gotten to a certain point and was like, look, I really have no interest in becoming a hospital dietitian. My interest laid in learning how to optimize performance and body composition and metabolism and all this kind of stuff, whereas the degree programs at that time was sort of more geared around, I guess, treatment and prevention of chronic disease and health in the country. So I funnily enough, Jackson Pios has been on your podcast before.
Yeah.
We've had conversations about this. So he went through a really good XBiz program, whereas like XBiz back in the day was like the human movements programs. And, you know, like I had a ton of, and even friends and colleagues and stuff at the time, it was all like public health promotion stuff. So there was like things that were like, you know, I guess like indigenous population, health prevention stuff. You'd pick a special population in the country and we'd look at health promotion roles there as well. Or like those were subjects that like we were looking at and that were part of these programs. Whereas now there seems to be, you know, a couple of programs that really specialize in the physiology and biochem, which is really cool. But when I was going through, man, like basically your prospects were, hey, you can be a dietitian, work in a hospital for someone who'd had a lap band surgery. And so I wasn't really interested in that. The idea of food services prac, like, you know, pulling food out of bins in the hospitals and stuff wasn't really all that appealing for me.
Can you explain that to me a little bit further? Because you mentioned that on the phone call and I tried to digest it and I didn't quite get it. So when you say pulling food out of bins, do you actually mean that's part of the job?
That's part of the food services prac, right? Like, so...
He was really just dieting really hard and super hungry. That's what he said.
Such an opportunist. Yeah,
so basically, and this is the thing, like for people who, if they're watching and listening to this and they're like, oh, like, you know, you hear of a metabolic ward study, right? And you're like, oh, they have the best controls. They have the best controls because they literally feed the people the food and then what doesn't get eaten gets put in the bin. And that's how they control for it. So like people will write out a meal plan and then the people who write out the meal plan are overseeing that are also seeing what is chucked in the bin.
What a dark side of the job.
Yeah. And that's like data collection for a lot of people, right? And, you know, like if people who are interested in the gut, you know, studying the gut, then the best controls for the gut, that means they're trawling through fecal matter, human or animal, depending on what they're looking at. So these are some of, I guess, the not so glorified sides of studies and stuff. But for me, I was like, look, I got to the point where I'd learned that people who'd had gastric sleeves, and those types of surgeries, their nutritional intake was completely different to what we knew was optimal for a, you know, normal functioning human being with a regular digestive tract. And hey, we need to have all these fruits and veg and meats and grains and all this stuff that's going to give us all these essential nutrients. And all of a sudden, it's like we've got to modify for that for this population. Now we've had this procedure done. So for me, I was like, I don't want to support that. My goals are body comp, metabolism, performance, all this kind of stuff. So I'd been involved with the ISSN for quite some time at that point. I knew they had some exams and stuff. And I was talking to the insurers and I was like, look, some places use the ISSN already. I'm involved with them. How do I, can we use that? And they were like, look, the biggest problem that you have is like, that's a pass-fail exam. That's a multiple choice exam. And yes, it's okay. But where does dietetics start and stop and where does sports nutrition take over? And that's what we need to be able to ascertained.
Can you explain to us real quickly what the ISSN is?
So
I said that really badly. I just stumbled on my words. ISSN.
So that's the International Society of Sports Nutrition. And I think this year we have the 16th annual conference, right? So I'm going to say they've been around for 16 years. Sports nutrition formally isn't very old as far as it goes, you know, sort of like 16, 17 years. They got together and were like, let's get our heads together and start sharing information so that way we can grow this thing. Mm-hmm. And when we say sports nutrition, we don't mean just like sporting teams and athletes. We mean things like bodybuilding, physique athletes, strength athletes, anything that's geared to a specific outcome that's really not health orientated, whilst health may be intrinsically linked with, body composition or performance. We're talking about the pursuits of, I guess, the upper echelon of that, which, you know, as we see at times, sort of may not be the most healthy approach as well. So basically, I've been involved with them and they had these exams. So there's a graduate exam. So if you've done like an undergrad degree, there's the CISSN, which is like certified. And then if you're an undergrad and you've had some exposure at a uni level or educational level, then that's the ISSN SNS. And so like a fair few people in Australia now have sort of both of them. But as far as like being a sports nutritionist is concerned within the country, it's really one of these things where it's like, hey, we've got to, we had to establish where the line of sports nutrition really was and where that scope was. Mm-hmm. So part of that was we got together with my, I got together with a couple of the colleagues who had finished those dietetics programs back in the day and were doing post-grad, whether it would be their masters or PhDs and stuff. And well, typically for a dietitian anyway, they do their masters. So one of my good friends and colleagues, Dr. Cam McDonald, had just finished his PhD at the time. And I was like, look, you know, like there's this risk assessment that we really need to do. You know, like the FMS at the time was like a functional movement screen. Let's just do something like that in nutrition. So that way we can, you know, have this red, amber and green system to say high risk, moderate risk and low risk. And then how these two worlds can come together and sort of work. And Cam's a really good guy in that he's extremely visionary with how he sees things and works, like especially in the projects that he's in. So like right now, Cam's the national director of this epigenetics program that's international now and sort of like links into like, you know, Branson, and they're constantly on TED Talks and all this kind of stuff. But back then he was like, look, we need to be equipping the fitness industry with these tools to be able to identify these risks and work with these people and sort of appreciate it. Because everyone sort of like comes from this background, right, where it's like, I know about nutrition. You know, I did a bodybuilding comp, or I know about nutrition. I've tracked my food for 3 years. Like, and it's like, okay, cool. You're a little bit nutritionally literate, but tracking food is sort of one component of, you know, like one module of 30 different modules that we have in our certificate program, I guess, to highlight its thing. And it, like, you know, if you've competed, it shows that you might understand how to be disciplined with your diet, disciplined with your training, but it doesn't mean you can transfer that onto another human being, right? Who's not you. So we basically created this screening system, took it back to the insurers. They were like, yep, this is good. And then from there, we linked the two up with the ISSN. And then I did the first ever sort of intake, right? And it was just this me in front of a whiteboard being like, this is what you quizzed on. You know, like this is what you need to be considering in practice. And that was it. And within about a year to 18 months, word of mouth had just gotten out, and every sort of 4 to 6 months people were asking me, and they're like, hey, can we do this next like course? We want to get qualified and stuff. And it wasn't something that I set out to do and replicate by any means. I was sort of all in on the training at another health center at the time. And after about 18 months, we'd probably put say 50 people through, and then the insurers came back and they were like, right, you need to start regulating this, right? Like best practice. We can't have all these policies going out and it not be enforced. So we'll help you incorporate a non-for-profit, set up best practices. We'll help you with trademarking, introduce you to the state health ombudsman bodies, get a relationship there and sort of progress that. And like, that's a pretty lengthy process to go through, you know, I guess from the get-go to there, you know, trademarking and all that kind of stuff, you know, and incorporation, doing it properly and doing a proper due diligence on it. You know, where you're having like showing your figures, projections, doing your annual figures and saying all this kind of stuff. It takes a bit of a while. So it was probably about 18 months later. That's when Sports Nutrition Australia was properly founded. So that's probably 2.5-3 years ago now. And we've just sort of been going slowly ever since. And as a result, I get to meet people like yourself, Brendan, and you know, people like Kyle, just I guess through the traps, and you know, like if values align, then really cool things happen from there. So
Kyle, I'm going to come to you in a second. One question I do have for you, Alex. What was the process prior to Sports Nutrition Australia in Australia? So I got my PT certs, it must have been in 2006, maybe 2005. I've never actually done a single PT session in my life. But I know that the majority of PTs who've done their Cert 3 and 4 know that they should refer out, but probably don't, based on the assumption that they track their food, like you said, so they feel somewhat qualified, or they've done a bodybuilding comp and so they feel somewhat qualified, but they're not actually qualified, they're not qualified or legally able to give advice. So what was the process prior to you guys in Australia?
Man, honestly, like it was like there was all these little weekend warrior workshops, really. That's how I'd describe it. There was nothing that sort of, and like to be fair, you know, 5.5 years ago when we were doing this, this was an 8-week program back then that didn't have what it has now, right? Like now it's 16 weeks and, you know, there's a bunch of different competencies that we've got and need to address and compliance levels that we need to meet. And that's for the certificate program. And that certificate program then bridges into graduate diploma programs and then other undergraduate programs into second and third year, depending on the program that is, with universities that we link in with now. And so it's sort of, it's very much snowballed. And so like prior to then, there was just like, you know, like we spoke about on the phone, there was like precision nutrition and that really coached around the behaviors around like nutrition. And it didn't elaborate or go into much detail on, you know, like, I guess, you know, if you're giving someone carbohydrates, why are you giving that? How confident do you feel in that answer? You know, why this much protein, right? And so that was pretty much all that existed, right? And we had this, I guess, foundation of people providing advice on a house of cards, really.
Yes.
And so, you know, and the thing is, like, you don't realize, like, I only, like you know, I say this, I spoke at the conference in February that we hosted with a bunch of the ISSN guys and then top sports nutritionists in the world came out and presented. And I was saying, like, my motivation for this stuff initially, it wasn't something where it was like, hey, let's help the industry. It was like, I've got to cover my ass. Like, it was self-serving, you know? It was like, I'm not going to make any warranties other than the fact that, yeah, it was to cover my own ass. Because here I am hearing this information where it's like, oh, you're liable for 7 years. And I'm like, oh, crap. Like, I want to buy a property. You know, yes. Here I am, like, 24 years old, and I'm like, okay, I'd like to get to a point of financial independence at some point in my life, and I don't want to be looking over my shoulder thinking, oh, you know, those meal plans that I was writing, the trainers that were working for me are writing, are they going to get me into trouble? And so I was like, all right, I'm going to nail this. But a lot of people just aren't aware of, I guess, the litigious nature of the industry at this stage as well. And because, like, a lot of the cases that we have, you know, as soon as I started, you know, I pulled on the thread and then it just kept going.
Yeah.
And as soon as I started hearing this stuff, it just sort of, again, it just snowballed in terms of my understanding of it. And so, you know, like, the majority of claims are settled as non-disclosure claims. We've had just over 1,000% increase in the last 3 years of claims in the fitness industry in the whole. Now, nutrition is about 10% of that when it comes to fitness industry and nutrition. However, it's probably increased about 1,300%, not just 1,000% from the nutrition side of things.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, like, I'm a firm believer that if you're good in the industry and you've got really good intentions and you can be as consistent with your own training and nutrition, well, be as consistent with your own business as you are your training and nutrition in the long term, then, yeah, like, you'll be successful. Then you deserve an opportunity to be able to, you know, like, not in the northern beaches of Sydney or anything like that, but, like, you know, own a property or two, like we spoke about, like, pay those things off, you know, raise your family comfortably and be in a somewhat comfortable financial position. My bias in the last 5 and a bit years is that I personally believe the model as a sports nutritionist is better than that of the saturated PT market. And because of our standards and practicing standards that we have within the body now, in that, you know, people come in, they'll do the cert. If you stay in the industry and this is somewhere that you're going to be longer term, then within 3 years, they got to do the grad dip. That means that that's the minimum standard qualification that we have for our members now. And we get people who come in and they're like, hey, I've done X-Phys 8 years ago, for 4 years ago, whatever, or an X-Science program. And it's like, cool, you don't need to do the grad dip, but we've got these subjects that we can RPL you for with a certificate, you know, and just pick up the remaining subjects that you need to from there. And then you can add that in, right? So for us, it's about helping people have a successful, sustainable career and be fully covered and aware of, like, what they're covered for, so that way they're operating, you know, in a really safe space for that sustainability long term.
Yeah, wicked. Kyle, jump in, the bodybuilding man. So how did you come into the mix with Sports Nutrition Australia?
Man, I was the guy that needed Alex. The guy that Alex was lucky that he wasn't. I was like every other bodybuilder in the country that decided to do the sport and think that they knew everything about it because they dieted for a little while. Now, I won't make myself sound completely off track. Like, I did go through.
Scott's got a degree. Like, this guy's got a degree.
It's not that bad, right? But in all essence, One thing that really struck me with Alex, and which you just mentioned before, was that you don't really know what you can do. And realistically, in bodybuilding, it's a tough gig, and we all know that there's a lot of practices in there that you literally take your body to extremes. You know, you shouldn't be actually trying to diet people to just skim the levels of condition. It's unhealthy. And everything that you get taught going through a nutrition degree at uni has zero relevance to body composition and altering anything to do, especially not with sport. So I just decided, like, I'd done bodybuilding for 8 years, and I just sort of went through uni, had a whole heap of other stuff, and it was just my focus. And I was like, well, I got to a point where I coached enough people, I'd done it for ages, and I got to a level with my career that I just didn't want to keep doing the same thing. I didn't want to keep coaching, you know, clients to win things. It didn't feel like anything for me. And back then, you know, there wasn't online coaches. I started online. Well, that's a lie. I did PT for like 4 months and then quit. I went through one of those like real dodgy orgs where like I signed up at this gym and I won't name them, but they had me training people. I wasn't qualified to train shit. And I was running around. They're like, oh, it's so good. Like, as long as you're training here, like, we'll mark you off. I'm like, oh, sounds legit, right? That's awesome.
The dark secrets of the industry are out.
Discovered very, very quickly how much I hate training people. So I didn't want anything to do with being in person. Any level of contact that I could have online was favorable to me. And I grew up having overseas US bodybuilding coaches because I always came with the opinion that, you know, if I was going to learn from someone and I wanted to do well in the sport, it had to be someone that either had achieved a high level or coached other people to achieve a really high level.
Who were some of the guys that were your coaches?
I had Shelby Starnes, Matt Porter, and John Meadows. So,
and yes, 3DMJ back in the day as well.
Yeah, like, 3DMJ. I was with Alberto Nunez for a little bit. That was when I was real young. So, anyone that knows bodybuilding would know those guys, yes. And they would know the results that they produce. So, I grew up learning from them, and they were my mentors. And when I was coming up in Australia, you know, no one was really doing online stuff. It wasn't a thing, and I went straight into online. I didn't do in-person stuff. I didn't want to do consults and stuff like that because I knew how successful you could get someone on a bodybuilding stage, not business-wise, but just bodybuilding, by just online check-ins. And I took that information from the coaches and I learned from it, and then I adapted my own way of doing things from the information that I knew. And, you know, I thankfully, through uni, you get a base of understanding of physiology, right? And I was able to apply that. And what I believe set me apart was my ability to apply that from the bodybuilding side of things that I learned from the coaches that I had. And so at least that gave me some kind of a background, but there was still nothing. And after a while of coaching these people and doing shows after shows, I got over it and I wanted to do something a little bit different. And it was always a passion of mine to try to educate coaches how to coach better. And the reason for that is quite selfish because I had a lot of clients that I had coached, they'd done well, they'd won comps, and then all of a sudden they just go, yeah, guess what, I'm opening my online prep coaching thing. I could name handfuls of them. And it was just, it angered me, it frustrated me. I was like, what the hell do you guys think you're doing? I'm this, I've done all of this, how could you go against me? All this sort of shit, right? And then I just realized, look, there's no point in me arguing against that. I don't want to be out there saying, look, you can't be doing this, I'm better than you because of blah, blah, blah. I thought, well, a better avenue for me to take is to just show these guys how to do it properly and how to do it a way that I knew how to do it, because you're not gonna stop them. And this is something that I think a lot of people need to understand, is that you can't make someone stop practicing the way that they are. The best thing you can do is educate them on what can happen if they continue, and educate them on better practices that can actually prove better results for the client. And so I wanted to do that. Now, I created my own thing called a Prep Coach Academy, and it was great. I loved it. I put everything into it until Alex messages me out of the blue. At the time, I had no idea about Sports Nutrition Australia. I thought Sports Nutrition Australia was just one of those companies.
It was a made up word.
It was one of those guys that, you know, were just launching random programs. I thought they were like a competitor to me. So he sends me a message and he's like, hey man, like you know, I can't really be doing this. Not covered by scope, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. It was a really well written message. Like, the way he approached me, I was like, first of all, who the hell is this guy? And then I dulled my bodybuilding ego and I was like, you know what, you're not better than everybody. He actually spoke to you really nicely, so let's give him the time of day. And when I read it, I was like, wow, this dude's pretty nice. He, like, I understand him. We were on the phone after that for like 3.5 hours, And to be honest with you, Brendan, like, I was shitting myself, because when he told me about the fact that I couldn't keep doing this, I couldn't prep coach, like, I couldn't teach prep coaches how to coach people and stuff like that because there was no regulation for comp prep, I was like, great, well, that's my career done. I'm going to go pack shells of Woolies because I don't know what else to do with myself. So I was like, Alex, whatever, man. Exactly. Yeah, I'm going back to PT. So thankfully, he arranged a time for me to come up to the Goldie because I'm from Canberra. Arranged time for me to go up to the Goldie, meet with him. And probably was 2 or 3 months after this phone call. And every day I remember working and shitting myself because I was like, is this for anything? Like, is he just going to throw the book at me and just go, yep, here's everything I'm suing you for? Or is he going to go, oh, that's all right. I was petrified. Anyway, so went up there, met with him, and he kind of goes, yeah, cool, man. Like, what you've got is really awesome. Show me what you've got. Walking through everything. And he was like, that's awesome. I can help you provide some scope. And I was like, wait, hang on a second, you big shot. That's mad. You mean you're not suing me? That's sick. Looks like I can work for the rest of my life after all. And so from there, Alex presented me with this opportunity. He told me a little bit more about SNA. And I had no idea about the depth and the scope of what was actually involved with creating a regulatory body, let alone creating a course that covers people for insurance. I used to brand my course, and look, I'll be the first to say it. I branded my course saying, become a certified comp prep coach, right? Now, I can tell you right now that there's at least 4 or 5 other institutions that have similar branding. Become a competition prep coach, get certified in nutrition. And I'm like, man, it's fucking 4 weeks, like, you're not gonna do shit. At least mine was a year long. So there was so many things in there, and you know, I was doing the same sort of thing, and Alex just sort of goes, look, well, here's the scope, here's what we can do to apply it, here's what we're allowed to do and what we're not allowed to do. And so I kind of went away and went, well, okay, here's an opportunity that I can actually do good for the industry and apply what I know alongside the actual regulations. Now, because I had no idea of it, Alex was influential in making that happen because he knew all about the ins and outs of it. And he still does. Like, I have no idea about the logistical stuff that he does. I don't want to, because it fries me. And I don't think a lot of people will ever have an understanding like it because they're not prepared to go down the right pathways to understand it. And so after a while, we got in contact with a couple of other guys that we both knew very well, and we both knew were good coaches, and we knew could actually provide something of benefit to a course that we could produce. And so we kept the same sort of methodology behind what I created and just applied that with the views of the other guys, the views of Alex, and the views of some other professionals that we knew to put it all together and develop a system for people that can actually get regulated and insured for contest prep best practice without giving specific recommendations on what you need to do. Because in bodybuilding, we know it's really individual, and we can never say you must do X to get Y. There's so many things that go into it. And as much as people would like to know exactly how much training to take, you can't tell someone that. So people need to know absolutes. And in bodybuilding, you've got to just be like, look, there isn't any. And we also aren't allowed to give you anything, because the reality is, the only research that we've been able to find on bodybuilding is probably max 4 or 5 years old. Like, it's really new stuff, and there's new stuff coming out more and more, but there's very general recommendations that are given, and they're by some top researchers. So like Gary Slater, like guys like that, you know, things like that, there's no expansion further on. And if that's all that's coming out there, that's all that we can go by. And from there, we kind of developed a system around, well, we know roughly what we can do, and we know what happens in bodybuilding. Like, we know the effects that people experience. We know that women lose their periods after a certain amount of time. We also understand that we know that amenorrhea happens as a result of low energy availability dropping below 30 calories per kilogram of lean body mass. So we know roughly why things occur, and we can use that to explain things and to add in things like contraindications to know, okay, if this happens, that's okay, you're aware of it, but we can establish a best practice based off of that. So obviously in that scenario, we know that we need to keep calories above that set number in order to offset and potentially mitigate the early onset of amenorrhea or irregular menses. Doesn't mean that it's not going to happen during a prep. It just means that we're aware of it and we can expect it to happen at certain points, and that we know it may happen. If it does, it doesn't mean that we're going, oh, I don't know. It's just part of bodybuilding. Like, yeah, everyone loses their period all the time. That's all good. Like, you'll get it back. No, that's not right. And so we've got a whole list of contraindications that we was kind of working against to go, well, look, this is what we need to do. And this is how we can apply it to people efficiently to make sure that they know best practice, they understand it, and they can do the right things to avoid any potential risks happening.
Yeah, I mean, because like really before, if we think about it, like if someone said, oh, I was going to do a bodybuilding show, or I'm in a prep, right? It was like, if I'd said to either of you guys, I was like, okay, so what's best practice in that? Like, what's the best practice? It'd be like, you know, someone would say, my client wins. Someone would say, my client has their glutes coming 20 weeks out, right? That's best practice. And so it was subjectively different for every single person. Another person would say, they just have a really positive experience. And so from our end, it was really just going back and working on a compliance side of things, you know, for establishing what that best practice was in an evidence-based manner. And like Kyle said, like, you know, there's some misconceptions that get thrown around, and like the internet's great for it. Like, look, we all make our livings as a result of the internet, but at the same time, it can constantly reinforce some bad ideas that aren't necessarily true. You know, people be like, oh, those scientists in the labs, they don't actually lift, you know, like they don't know what they're talking about. And it's like, yeah, that's actually not the truth. Like the guys who are out there publishing now, when it comes to like these, you know, physique and strength for sport specific athletes, are like some of the best athletes at that respective sport in the world.
Yeah.
You know, so like Greg Knuckles is one of the top researchers. He does a research review, you know, with Eric Helms in Mass and stuff. And Greg's exceptionally strong. You know, Eric is a really, really good powerlifter as well as professional bodybuilder as well. Like just to name a few. So it's not like these people with the lab coats are just nerds sitting in these labs. These are people like who are in the trenches doing these things and doing that. And so we get information from these guys, from the Gary Slaters of the world, and we can say, hey, look, this is what the evidence is suggesting right now. Now we have a framework for what best practice really is in an objective sense. So whilst glutes in 20 weeks out might be great, or, you know, first place trophy at a national level might be great, we've got these other things to be considerate of in an objective sense from a coach's perspective. So yeah, that was it. And I just want to add as well, like, I wasn't setting Kyle up the whole time. When we spoke initially, I was like, man, it's actually really good that someone's doing this for bodybuilding. I prep people for like a year, right? And like, I did pretty well at it. I had two or three athletes and they all won. So I'm just saying it over the record. I'm saying 100%. But no, in all seriousness, it's not something that I really enjoyed. Like I like metabolism more. That's what I learned through practice, right? Like I like working with people in a body comp sense more from a metabolism side of things. And I like working with performance athletes. So for me, I don't have a passion for that. He'd already done it. So I was like, man, this needs to be done. I'm happy to support you through it because I work in the logistics side of things anyway, right? So, you know, we'll just take what you've got, you know, polish it up the way that we need, send it through, get all the approvals that we need, and then we'll go from there. So that was pretty much it. And we're doing something similar with weight cutting sports in the next few months as well.
With fighters, right? Like fighters more so specifically.
Yeah. So like fighters, if it was like weightlifters, if it's like jockeys, anything like that, where they've got to make, you know, cut weight and make a certain weight. Again, there is a best practice for this and we have access to the information. We've got some really novel strategies that we can be employing, but you know, it's one of these things where like I get this presentation when we do the prep thing, right? And I'm like, you know, I've got that rice cakes and fish guy. And I'm like, this is what this guy's, you know, symbolic of bodybuilding 10 years ago, where you'd go to the biggest guy in the gym and you'd say, hey, what do I do? And they'd be like, lift heavy in the off season and then do some cardio and higher reps, lighter weight as you get ready for a comp and just starve yourself a little bit strategically, right? And whilst that's true, you know, obviously there's a lot of other things to do. Be mindful of in that way. And that's sort of like what fighting is, right? Like in these other sports where there's like weight making and it's like my trainers told me to do this, you know, go out and do the sauna suit runs and go and do these things. And, you know, like there's just slightly more effective and efficient ways to be doing things without putting yourself and your health at risk. So that's what we want to do. We just want to make people aware, right?
Do you think that the industry's changed a lot? Talking about rice cakes and fish. So I did my bodybuilding comps when I was 19, so 15 years ago. And I grew up in a bodybuilding world where you literally had oats for breakfast, like six small meals a day, oats for breakfast. And then it was basically chicken and rice. If you were lucky to have the rice, broccoli, and then occasionally you would have like red meat. And that was essentially your meal plan. And things have changed so much over the past 5 years, especially with like flexible dieting, macros, where people don't need to suffer as hard and get into great shape body composition wise. It's like we have a completely different understanding. From both of your point of view, have you seen that within the industry as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like it's becoming a lot more positive. And the focus is becoming a lot more on what you can do to get the best results rather than how much you need to suffer to get the best results. And don't get me wrong, it's still prevalent. A lot of people that do get into the sport get into it because they're coming at it from a negative aspect in the first place. So they're wanting to do bodybuilding, not to enhance their life or to improve anything, but to fix something about themselves. They think that there's something about them that they don't like. And so they believe that if they throw themselves into the sport, into the competition, they will get that body that they want, or they will get the discipline that they want, and that just leads them down a bad track. Whereas if the people come in with a very positive outlook, they can potentially and usually go down the right track of applying the best practice, doing the things where it doesn't require as much suffering, it doesn't require as much hard work as what the old guys used to talk about, and still get amazing results. And don't get me wrong, it doesn't mean that they don't work hard, it doesn't mean it's not difficult. Like, dieting sucks, training hard sucks, you know, and it's still hard regardless of what you do. But when you're coming at it from a decent place, and I feel more and more people are doing that now, it's just going to make it a much better experience. And it's good to see that positive shift.
Mm. Yeah, I know Kyle's a big... like he's against the whole like reinforcing that, you know, the person who wins is the one who's prepared to suffer the most. And whilst that might be a necessary like coaching tactical style for someone who, you know, needs to hear that at that point in time, that might be like 5% of the population respond really positively to that. But, you know, some stuff that we talk about is like any athletic pursuit, whether it be, you know, a sporting performance goal or, you know, a team goal or a physique sport goal, it should be something that enhances your life and not take away from it. And, you know, we've got this sort of, I guess, model where we look at, okay, what's the merit of their skill like when it comes to their nutritional awareness, their internal cues. So, you know, like how hungry are they? Do they know what true hunger is? Do they know what true satiety and satiation is? What overreaching with training feels like versus being underslept and all that kind of stuff. And then looking at those two things and then sort of cross-referencing that and I guess overlaying them with what the client's goals are, right? Like, is it a, you know, just a local show and rocking up and they've got really poor literacy, or is it, you know, or are they someone who's got amazing literacy and amazing internal self-awareness and then they want to be a world champion? Because how we coach those people and how we frame things and communicate is going to be completely different. And I guess that's where the psych contraindications and best practice comes from, is like, hey, we might be intending to take people on the same way really healthily and get them there and have a real optimal experience, but how we get them there will be, like, you know, very interpersonally dependent on, you know, I guess where they are and what they're looking to achieve in those areas.
So yeah, with that too, Alex touched on a good point where a lot of the older guys were in that big suffering mindset. Now, I was the same, and this is something that I believe a lot of coaches need to hear and will find a lot of value from. The way that we grew up into the sport, if you've been doing it for a while, is not always the way that we should be practicing for our clients. And it was a very big revelation for me to have, because when I was going through bodybuilding, it was from a place of, I wanted to lose weight, I wanted to get chicks, and then I realized that girls really didn't care too much about how I looked.
They really and don't, no.
They really don't, hey.
Yeah, like, man. The dad bod is coming back.
Speak or anything, but... You know, at the end of the day, they don't care. And I remember vividly, like, everything I did was so hyper-focused. Like, I lived it, breathed it, and for me, it was an area of suffering. I'll never forget. When I was growing up, I built a gym in my dad's garage. And in Canberra, you know how cold it gets here, man. Like, it was nuts. I used to get myself up 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning to go and train. And I go out into the garage. Now, everything was frozen, right? And so I would pick up a bar, and my hands would freeze to it. And I was like, oh shit, I can't do deadlifts and stuff now. So instead what I do was boil a kettle, fill up a jug with boiling water, go outside, dip my hands in the boiling water, and then lift the bar up. No. And I was like, wait. Now at the time, it wasn't me trying to prove anything. It was me going, I've got to train, I've got to suffer. Like, I don't care how you do it. Like, win at all costs. You've got to get every session in. That's how I grew up in it. And I know a lot of guys have done very similar sorts of things at different levels, right? Now, I never put that mentality onto my clients, but I did to an extent. I was always going, well, what are you prepared to do? How much are you prepared to give? You know, it's about how hard you can push, how hard you can go. Until it got to a point where I was still doing that when I was competing, but I also noticed that I wasn't putting it onto my clients, and my clients were doing way better than what I was. You know, I was never a gifted bodybuilder. Like, I just had big carbs and that was about it. So, but my clients were doing extremely well. And so it was a big turning point for me to go, you know what, maybe you don't need this big suffering thing. And then when I went on my own path of down the psychology route, I started to understand a little bit more about where it comes from and why a lot of people get into this sport to start with and what their motivations are going along with it. And when you can come out of that and just go, yeah, wow, I really did approach it from the wrong perspective and there is a different way that I can do it, because there was a lot of benefits that I got out of the lifestyle that I put into everything. I wouldn't have been able to work for myself from when I was 19 onwards if I hadn't gone through it. Like, it did teach me a lot of discipline. It taught me how to go home from school, not do any assignments, open up 40 tabs and do nothing but read bodybuilding.com until 4 a.m.
I got to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, I just got to clarify. So people that listen probably don't know, but I grew up in Canberra as well. So when I was in college, I had 32 unexplained absences in one term because I used to leave college to go and train. So I had that mentality as well. The other thing, talking about starting training to pick up chicks and then realizing that chicks don't get into it. So I was at the gym. I was ready for comp prep one. I was getting ready for comp one time. And the guys that I went to school with were like, man, you're in incredible shape. You must get so much pussy. And all I was thinking was, are you serious? All I do is just train and drink AST VP2. Like, literally down to the actual ingredient, like the actual product brand name. That's how I explained it. I was that,
Yeah.
But my question for you, Kyle, is with your research, why do people start bodybuilding, out of my own interest's sake?
Why do they start bodybuilding?
Yeah, what's the reasons that people get into it, the psychology behind it?
The most common reason is because they're wanting to fix something about themselves, like I said before. So it's coming from a very negative place. It's coming from a place of needing to have reassurance and having control. You'll find that a lot of people in bodybuilding are massive control freaks. And we can see that from the need to control our workouts, the need to control what we're putting into our bodies. And usually that stems from something in childhood that happened that caused us to not feel a whole lot of control. So for me personally, it was the fact that I was very distant as a kid. I was out there and outgoing a whole lot, but I didn't have a whole lot in a home environment. I kind of just kept to myself and did my own thing. My parents weren't really present for me. And so for me, the control aspect started to come from, well, I can't talk to them. I've got to do my own thing. So that went into the online looking at forums. Then when I wanted to lose weight because I looked different from all the other kids in school, I knew that I had to control my diet. I knew that I had to control my training. So I obsessed over it and it was a massive control thing. And it went down the route of needing to know every single number that I put into my body, logging into my fitness pal, calculating everything. You know, I used to weigh pepper. No joke. I would put my food on the scale and crack pepper on the thing, right? And then luckily it only did it for 2 days and I was like, oh, what the hell do you think you're doing? Like, let's get out of that. But most bodybuilders get into it because of this. And we can see it very, very strongly when people miss a workout and they freak out. They think it's the end of the world because they couldn't stick to their plan. Bodybuilders pride themselves on their ability to stick to a routine. Just hang on, I better get this guy. Yeah. they pride themselves in the ability to stick to a routine and can get anything in. And they go, I will make sure that I can get in all my cardio, all my training, all my meals, whatever it is. If something external happens, it takes away that control. So someone gets sick, your car breaks down, you injure yourself. Usually it causes a massive mental spiral down a bad pathway, which makes them go, well, I don't have control over this situation anymore. I don't know what to do. You find bodybuilders can't handle things like that. It's very, very difficult for people to have a situation like that happen during a prep, because as a competition draws closer and competitive engagement increases, the likelihood of these instances occurring is greater as well. And the more that you're actually wanting to step on stage and wanting to control things increases too. So if something like that happens when you're getting closer to a competition, they don't have the ability to go, yeah, like just got injured, whatever, like better work it out. You know, you better make sure that my leg's okay in the next 6 weeks so that I can squat again. They just go, I will go to the gym and I will wrap the crap out of myself. I will take whatever painkillers I got to take. I will do it. I did a whole prep on boatloads of painkillers because I couldn't squat, couldn't deadlift, couldn't do anything. But in my mind, I was like, I got to get it done. And we feel as though it's a self-validating thing too. A lot of bodybuilders are so insecure and we need to prove something, both to ourselves and to everybody else. And that's why, you know, we're obsessed with a sport that's about growing and being different, because we want to show that. You know, when it comes to our body image, most of the time we'll be wearing clothes that people look at and we think that they're judging us based off of how we feel and how we think that we look. Realistically, they got no care. You know, I went to a psych workshop for uni a couple of months back, and it was the first time that I'd been in a room and nobody made a single comment about my carbs. I was like, what's going on? For sure they're going to mention something. Like, maybe they're not as good. Maybe someone's seen something bigger in psychology world. But no, you know.
And it's just, they're not bodybuilders.
They're just not bodybuilders. They just don't care. And it really made me realize, like, wow, in our world of bodybuilding, so much of what we do is based around what we can try to control and how we feel about ourselves. And we're constantly trying to get better. And we mark that as a positive thing. We go, I always want to improve. But there's a big difference between I want to improve and I'm never good enough.
Yeah, so I didn't go to the beach. I live in Perth, man, and Perth has the best beaches in the world. I'm a little bit biased, but I didn't go to the beach from I was 20 until I was about maybe 25, 26, because I was too concerned that my chest wasn't in proportion to my shoulders. And I remember, like, and that's not even a joke. I was so concerned that I'll be judged for it. And then when I was maybe 28, I just remember that year I was just in great shape. It was a great summer, like beach every day, tan everywhere. And I was so proud. And it wasn't until I got into CrossFit, which is a performance-based sport or an athletic-based sport as opposed to an aesthetics-based sport, that I understood no one actually cared except for me. And I was like, oh, wow, that was like a pretty big self-limitation that you put on yourself that was really unnecessary. So yeah, I can relate to what you're saying in a big way.
It's massive, man. And that's a perfect example. And I can guarantee that a large majority of your listeners would have gotten into it for the same sort of reason. There'll be so many people out there that would have been like me and would be needing to wear a rash vest at every swimming carnival in school, that wouldn't avoid any aspect of needing to take their shirt off. You know, I was covered in acne as a kid. And so that made it even worse. I was like, I definitely can't take my shirt off, but I couldn't show off what I'd been working on either because I had pimples all over it. So I was like, oh shit, I can't let anyone know. Let alone, like, there are other kids that were, you know, riddled with acne too. They didn't care. But because I was so into this bodybuilding and caring so much about, like, my muscles and how much body fat I had, it made everything else and my other insecurities so much worse.
It's like, this is going to get like a bit mindset-y, but it's I would say, if I could quickly wrap it up, and this is just my observational experience, which is pretty limited, right? But it's people tend to take action from a place of moving away from pain. So, like, I'll finally take action to move away from pain towards something. Mm-hmm. And then what they're moving toward comes from a place of have, do, be, rather than be, do, have, which sounds weird as hell when I say it like that, but I'll explain it as, if I have this good body, then I can go out and do those things, like go to the beach, and then I will be happy.
Yeah.
As opposed to being happy, doing the things that help reinforce your happiness and vitality, and then having things that then come from that as well. So it's this sort of fucked up complex and cycle that people move away from something and then seek these other things in this reverse order that we shouldn't be anyway. And, you know, physique sports, and like Kyle really touched on like the bodybuilding side of things, but now, you know, like we're seeing like the inception of the WBFF, especially on the East Coast, and, you know, just like the IFBB bikini and all this kind of stuff as well. Like, it's like that competitive mindset of this bodybuilding mindset, it's transformed to like physique sport athletes and, you know, bikini athletes doing a 20-week prep and having peak weeks. For God, yeah. Like God knows why you're having a peak week. But anyway, like, you know, things like that. And it's because like they're looking at these girls who they look up to online and they're like, yep, you know, like, oh, they've got it all. When I look like that, I can do these things.
Oh, Alex,
the leaner we get.
There we go. You're back in.
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Yeah. Like Kyle was saying, like the leaner we get, like we've got this, you know, science supports it now. The leaner we get, the more neurotic we become. The more we track and control things, the more neurotic we become. So these things are like geared to screw us up if we're in a bad state. You know, and it's like these people looking from the outside in being like, oh, so-and-so bikini pro in the IFBB or WFF pro, like, oh, you know, like they've got it made. It's like, yeah, like 90% of them are struggling with massive issues. And from us who have experienced and can like, I know these people, we're like, you're better where you are. Just work, like work on you.
And we know that because they talk to us. Like we, they go through the course or they reach out. Like we know what they're really dealing with and what they're really going through. And that's where a lot of the motivation for, you know, the courses and the growth of SNA comes from is like, we're dealing with it all the time. Something needs to happen to at least slow down the negative occurrences that keep happening from more and more vulnerable people.
I think like in today's age of social media, so I spoke about it with Alice on a podcast that we did on body image awareness, because a lot of her clients are in that boat as well and that WBFF-esque sort of market. And we spoke about, people talk about social media, but it was even in the magazines, but now it's just in your face all the time that you see someone and that's the expectation of what you want to reach. So without going too much into mindset, talking about nutrition so we can bring it around, I want to go through, before we wrap it up, I want to go through fads with you guys, fad diets.
So to
set it up, 2 years ago, I went through 12 months of extreme dieting on myself where I went through 4 diets over 3 months each. So I started off with just like a standard out of the magazine diet, which was provided by a supplement company. So pretty balanced diet. Nothing too crazy, but I just wanted to control for the first 3 months. I then did keto for 3 months, vegan for 3 months, and flexible dieting. Or more, I tried to be a little bit more elaborate and let's call it if it fits your macros. So I tried to add as much as what I could in there. DEXA scans, blood tests, resting metabolic rates, VO2 max testing, everything was done. Now, I went into it after, at that stage, 14 years in the industry, mainly from a supplement standpoint. But from me hearing so many things about these different diets, the benefits of them, you know, keto was really big at the time, you know, with cognitive enhancement, reducing inflammation. I got to the end of the 12 months expecting to be able to give people such great advice. And it was really anticlimax because my blood's hardly changed throughout the whole diet. I wanted to build muscle, I needed to create a stimulation for muscle growth and have enough protein in my diet. If I wanted to lose body fat, I'd be in a deficit. If I wanted to improve my VO2 max or essentially my fitness, I needed to force an adaptation to do that. Outside of that, all of these promises from the diets made very, very little difference. So you guys streamlining what you're doing, what do you find in the industry with these sorts of things that come out? Or your experience of anything specific?
Man, it always, for me anyway, it always just comes down to physiology. Like we are designed to function a certain way. You're not going to change that. You know, we need to have carbohydrates to fuel anaerobic performance. Like it's known. So I know that you can have keto or you can do the carnivore diet or whatever and get other energy sources out of it. Is that going to be better? No. Might it make you feel better? Possibly if you have a confirmation bias behind wanting to do something different because everything you've tried so far hasn't given you the results that you wanted. So you wanted to find something else to justify something new. But at the end of the day, like you said, creating a stimulus is for growth and hypertrophy in the training world is the exact same thing used for eating to perform better.
Yes.
Eating at a but eating at a surplus. They're going to do specific things. Anything around that, you're not going to change. And I feel like people that do go on all the fads and stuff like that, don't get me wrong, I've gone through everything possible that you can think of. When I was learning everything myself, anything like different fasting windows, I've done, you know, 48-hour fast before and eat for 5 days a week, like just crazy shit, right? And was it better or worse than anything else? No. The best thing for me was something that was sustainable for my life. Like I've got a kid, I work, yeah. I travel, you know, I need to make sure that I have the nutritional literacy to understand how to eat when I'm on the road, how to eat when I've got family events coming up, how to make sure that if my daughter's eating something, I can eat something with her to keep me happy because it's a priority. I need to understand how to do all that and have the knowledge to know how I can make results at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I feel like people can understand that and build up that literacy, it's going to work in their favor. But for as long as they're avoiding it, they're going to keep falling into the pathway of following these fads. And all these fads discredit the fact that there's a lifestyle component involved that needs to be addressed at a very high priority. And if you're not following something that you can apply to your life, not just for 12 weeks, not just for 12 months, but for 10, 15 years, then realistically, it's not going to be the best thing for you. And a lot of people will use the, I did keto, I've been doing it for a year, I feel great, never eating in a different style again. Okay, well, let's wait and see where your life goes in the next 5-10 years time and what happens to you. Can you sustain it?
Yeah.
When we 100%. Hear these things now, as like practitioners, we're just sitting there just like, oh, like you might be part of the one percentile that actually adheres to it in 3 years time. But, you know, like, we want you to be able to have the tools to be able to succeed irrespective of having such a strict and inflexible approach sort of like long term. And I would say, Brennan, it's so interesting that that was your experience, right? They all just fell flat, but it just goes to show, mate, you are like right in the middle of the bell curve, man. Like when I was young and I was like an aspiring athlete playing rugby and basketball and swimming at like state and national level and certain things, and I'd be like, you know, I'm an outlier, I think, you know, like I can train harder. I can program my lifts at like 90% of my one rep max and do 6 reps for sets, and I'm not going to injure myself and all this shit, and these nutritional programs and nutrient timing things are going to be amazing and stuff. And it was like, no, I'm just an average human being, right? Like,
yeah,
I just probably did more accumulative hours of sports when I was younger than the people that I was going up against. That's probably what it was. And that's what we see, right? Like Kyle said, you can't feel full physiology. And like, it depends on where people sit, right? Like for me personally, where I sit, that's, I guess, different to the majority is I oxidize and utilize carbohydrates extremely easily. So yes. I go keto myself. I go hypoglycemic extremely easily. I feel like shit. That's probably like one of my only sort of like outlier-esque standard deviations from the mean things that I represent personally. You know, the same way that Kyle has huge carbs. You know, like that's his thing, right? Like we've all got a few things that we're different in, but. You know, like when it comes to these, I've just got my dog telling me she wants to go.
I was gonna say
go
the dogs are doing okay through this cast. We've only
nah, she's telling me, man, she's a pushy little thing. But anyway, come on in your bed. But then, like the thing is that, like when it comes to weight loss, exercise and movement and lifestyle is king, right? Like the people that lose weight and keep it off, they tend to be more active by over 500 calories a day, and this is like it's a huge amount for the people who have successful lifestyle weight loss long term. Like it's a huge portion of those people are greatly more active. And so while we'll see infographics online and it'll say like this cheeseburger or this burger has 500 calories, it takes 2 hours of running on the treadmill to burn that off, so just say no to the burger, it's like, yeah, just spend more time exercising, because we know, like the data suggests, that people who are exercising more have the greatest sustainable weight loss long term and healthier body compositions, right? Part of that is because it's time that you're not spending thinking about food. And then when you do train and you're training, you're like, hey, I don't feel like eating that much junk around it because I'll probably spew. So, you know, there's those things that sort of go into it as well. So like physical activity and like the specificity of it will have a huge influence, right? And then like your lifestyle, like Cole said, like if he's a tree lopper and And then he goes, like, I'm having heaps and heaps of carbs. And then all of a sudden he goes, all right, I'm going to try keto. He might feel like shit. And yeah. that has nothing to do with genetics. That's purely environment, right? And then all of a sudden he stops tree lopping and he's an online coach. And then he's like, man, this keto thing's great. Well, it's because he's just gone from being like super labor intensive 10 hours a day to completely sedentary 10 hours a day as well. And so there's just a high level of like, almost like religious fanaticism when it comes to these diets and stuff, and just a real lack of critical thinking when it comes to like basic physiology and exercise physiology, and then applying that with nutritional physiology when it comes to these things.
So then from your point of view, from a logistics point of view, and with Sports Nutrition Australia, because obviously you want best practice. And so if we have companies out there, and I'm not going to mention who they are, but we know who they are, and they're recommending these sort of diets, and they get their practitioners or distributors on board, and then they start giving health or nutrition recommendations, but they don't have any knowledge of their own outside of the pamphlets, which they got taught on. This really isn't regulated in Australia or
like, I mean, the supplement industry is crazy, right?
Yeah,
like,
actually, let's not even talk about these ones. Let's just talk about the general supplement industry, you know, because that's where I grew up. So we're not picking on anyone specifically.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Like, you think about it, like someone goes in and they're like, all right, I'm go to my local supplement store and I want a fat burner, and it's old mate who's 150 kilos, hypertensive, and he's on, like, you know, blood pressure meds and potentially got fatty liver as well, right? And it's like, all right, I need to lose weight. And it's like, here, have this ultra strong thermogenic that's going to be banned in the next 2 years. And, you know, like, old mate drops dead from a heart attack because he's screwed. And it turns out like things like, you know, people are on beta blockers, right? Beta blockers, and people don't understand, like, and this is sort of the thing, one of the things that we screen for, and it's sort of like one of the real obvious things, like early on in the screen, but it's like, if you are on beta blockers and you eat grapefruit or have just grapefruit or certain grape seed extracts, it will kill you.
Oh, wow.
Like, without a doubt. So, like, just something like that, right? So, it's like a supplement is this fat burner, and it's got Garcinia cambogia and sinephrine and, you know, hordenine and whatever else is in it. Like,
I know what, like, you're talking about.
13-methyltrilamine or some shit, you know, whatever the new name is that they're putting on, you know, like, methamphetamine that's just not really well cooked, and you know, because that's what it is, right? Like, let's just say it for what it is, and then it's got some bit of grapefruit extract or something in there as well, and it's like, sweet, we've just elevated your heart rate and now you've had the thing that's toxic with your medication, they're gone, right? So it's like, we've seen it, like, if flukily it's just worked out pretty well, but you know, it's just one of these things where, like, it's pretty scary, like, what could happen. But at the end of the day, like, it comes back to the sub store owners first and foremost, you know. They, like, everyone's going to, like, in our industry, and, like, I would say within Australia, we've got this tall poppy, like, syndrome, and it's part of our culture, and I'd like to see that changing. And it's where, like, people will always blame the next person they deem to be responsible without taking responsibility for themselves first. And so they'll turn around and be like, oh, well, the manufacturer or supplier, you know, person who's got the license or for whatever it is like that, you know, they told me this and it's their fault. And it's like, you know, at some point, everyone's got to realize the buck stops with them, right? Like, that's what it comes down to. Like, Kyle actually used to own a supplement store and stuff. So I'll let him tell you some stories as well. I'm going to let you know that quickly. Give me a sec.
Yeah. Like, a really good point to bring onto that too is, now that grapefruit sales are going to plummet, people go, oh, I'm on beta blockers, I can't have grapefruit because that's going to kill me, right? Now, this is the same mentality as a fad diet, okay? It's not just grapefruit. It's the fact that you're having that plus the beta blockers, plus the elevated heart rate, the high blood pressure, all that kind of stuff works synergistically together to drop you dead, right? But people will take one thing. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's the worst thing or whatever. They will go, oh, okay, well, this is the enemy. And you will see grapefruit linked to death.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
We'll go, oh my God, I can't have grapefruit now, you know? And that's where it happens in the supplement industry. And it happens in our industry by, you know, these are the top foods to avoid if you want to lose belly fat.
You know,
it's the same sort of thing. And in supplements, man, like, the sad part is that most things only happen at a regulatory level when a critical incident occurs. So, if somebody dies as a result of taking something, the TGA will crack down super hard on whatever it may be and pull everything off the shelf that's close to it or resembles it, and we'll do a massive look at it. And then people will end up not understanding why it really happened, and not talking ad lib about it. And instead, manufacturers will develop products that will be chemically similar to that, that will create the same impact in the body, not actually going, hey, this actually happened, maybe we shouldn't make it anymore. They go, ah, shit, that ingredient got caught. How do we make one that's like it that has a different name so we'll pass the standards?
Yeah, it's been cat and mouse for years, man. There's always been usually a high stimulant, but it will come out, and then as soon as that gets banned, there will be the closest molecule in, you know, the next big product. So we saw that with Craze, and Craze got under the radar for a long time.
Yeah, man, that was so good.
Yeah,
we talk about it all the time.
Knocking people dead. Gentlemen, I reckon that we could go for a while, but we could chat for a long, long time. But you guys are coming to Perth, so first of all, tell us about your workshop in Perth, because this is going to be a bodybuilding comp prep specific workshop. So tell us about the workshop. Who's it for? Who should go?
I'll let Kyle handle it. He's the bodybuilding guy. He's the physique coach.
He's just the logistics guy, so he's booked the flights and everything for us. Now I've been talking about it. Better to be job. So we're running as part of the accreditation. We're running 4 workshops. We've already done one in Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney. Now we're coming across to your side of the world and presenting on our best practice and our practice and standards, and all the different contraindications that we know, both for pre-season, for off-season, for post-contest, and for peaking as well. We're not giving specific recommendations, but we're going through best practice of what that's going to be, so people that are coaching others in the industry can understand what can potentially happen and how to best avoid it. And the reason that we're doing it is so that we can create the best coaches possible that are willing to invest in actually turning this into a career, not just something that they can put on their checklist of CEC points. That we want people to understand that this is actually becoming something that you can have a solid career path in if you want to go down the route. If you love bodybuilding as much as what I do, as much as what Brandon does, as much as Joey does, then you can actually make something of it. It doesn't need to be a side gig. The only rule is that you need to follow the right pathway, just like you would for any other professional career. And so we're providing that pathway now for people to come along and have a look. It's a full-day workshop, so it's from 9 to 4:30. And throughout that process, they will learn everything that they've got to understand about different phases in contest prep when it comes to what they need to prepare for physiologically, psychologically, different contraindications that we worry about and that we know. So we'll be presenting all the best research that we know, the most relevant stuff that we can actually apply to bodybuilding as well, and educating people on what we don't know. Because it's very common in bodybuilding that we will go, oh, well, this has to be this way because such and such papers said whatever it did back in the 70s. So I'm just going to assume that. Well, no, you can't. We need to explain to people like what isn't actually known yet. And because of that, that comes under our best practice of letting people to understand that because we don't know it, we can't actually tell people to do it and be covered for it.
Yeah. I was going to say, what do they come away with? Oh, sorry, Alex, you jump in because
Kyle hit the nail on the head as far as like coaches, like the aspiring coaches in this. But like, even if it's just for coaches who you're not sure and you just want to know more about bodybuilding, or even just the general public, right? And you genuinely want to compete. You want to know what, you know, like competing is. Come in and check it out. This is what this day is for. It's $300 for the day or $299 for the day. It's not like a full accreditation program. This is just like the taster for it. So that way, if you're someone who's just interested in competing, or you've competed before and you want to know what best practice is, or like what a good prep should look like, and what that timeline with a coach should look like, we can show you, and we can, you know, reference it and all this kind of stuff. But we take the best of the research that we've got at the moment, then we take the best of the anecdotal information and experience that we've got from the top guys in the industry and put it together. And this is what's amalgamated. So that way people can start understanding, look, here's the weird and wide and wonderful world of prep. And we go, right, that's where we want to be operating within, and that's what it should look like. So that way people can just be more aware of what, you know, best practice is. And we say best practice, we've said a lot. It's like, really, it's just a framework. It's not like you have to do it exactly like this. That's why Kyle's saying it's not specific, you know, dosing and recommendations of nutrients or anything like that. It's like, this is the level of critical thinking that's needed. This is what it should look like. here's some frameworks and models to make it more effective, and all these other crazy things that are resulting in like hospitalizations before peak weeks, hospitalizations after peak weeks, you know, people having like the most crazy post-comp blues and stuff. We can avoid a lot of these extreme cases that are eventuating, you know, so that way they can come out and sort of know what that foundation they should have in place before they start the prep looks like, what the journey should entail, and then what that recovery and post-comp phase sort of like looks like from there.
If you want to become an evidence-based practitioner or prep coach, like what a lot of people are trying to do these days, then we're going to be presenting the evidence to people so they can actually walk away and apply that rather than just putting it in the handle.
Wicked.
And not pseudoscience, right? And I explain this a lot in the certificate programs that we run and when I'm like introducing people into the graduate diploma bridging pathway. And, you know, people will say like, oh, like the Krebs cycle, like there's a rate limiting step at the end of the Krebs cycle and it's where oxaloacetate converts back. And there's an enzyme, pyruvate carboxylase, that sort of is needed for that last step to occur, right? And pyruvate carboxylase is rate limited by carbohydrate. And so in one of the lecture videos insert, I talk about that and people are like, so this is why people must always have high carbs. And I'm like, no. That's one possible explanation, right? Yes. And so being so conclusive and so 100% of that and saying this is why carbs, that's pseudoscience, right? Like this is one possible explanation is a balanced way of presenting it. But what pseudoscience is me saying, I'm going to throw all this wordy shit at you just because I know more about science and biochemistry than you do. And now I'm going to basically gaslight you into believing what I'm saying is true. And you've got no way of proving it otherwise because you don't know better. Or it just makes sense enough, you know, for that to be the case, right? It's like, you know, like chronic inflammation is what's causing these problems and stuff. And it's like, yeah, that makes enough sense. Like I'm providing you with enough information for you sort of to draw that conclusion, but I'm leading you in that way. And it's not pseudoscience. We're not presenting it in a way where, like Kyle said, like we will be sat, it's presented in a way where it's extremely balanced, in a way where it's like, we don't know. Like, we don't know this. We're not going to make these conclusions yet. So that way people can feel comfortable and we want to start encouraging people saying they don't know and working with these higher level specialists. You know, we've got some of the world's top PhDs in our network, some of the most specialist dietitians and sports doctors who we work with who are amazing in these little niche areas. And this is what it's about. Collaboration, you know, for sustainable success.
If people want to know more about pseudoscience or hear the word pseudoscience more, please go check our podcast with Jackson Pierce.
check it out for sure. Check it out for sure.
Now,
they need to know more.
one final question that I have about Sports Nutrition Australia and your main course. So if somebody wants to be qualified as a sports nutritionist through the main course, who should look at that and what's involved?
Okay, so the main course that we run at the moment is the Certificate in Applied Sports Nutrition. That allows them to get accredited. So that course ranges from just over $3,000 to, you know, like a high end of $3,000. We've got multiple different payment plans, so it depends on the payment plan that you've got. We've got weekly, fortnightly, monthly, so they all increase based on the duration. And that is our entry-level foundational course, right? So the way I mentioned this earlier, so that will allow them to register as an accredited sports nutritionist and then get the cover. And if they have a degree or anything like that, then they don't need to go on, or like a relevant degree, I should say. Like, I don't want to sound bad. Like, if you're a naturopath, I'm sorry, but if you do, like, say, a Bachelor of Health Science naturopathy, that's not relevant enough. It's got to be, there's like a couple of programs that we've got. So there's a couple of food and nutrition programs that have some really hard out biochem and physiology subjects. Like we actually have to look at the transcripts and stuff for these things. But say you've got a relevant degree, you don't have to go on otherwise within 3 years, then there's that stepping process into the graduate diploma in applied sports nutrition. So the certificate really provides them with that provisional level of cover. So it's like being on your P's, right? It actually is. So like you do the cert as of 2020. So like we're August now. That's when it comes into play, where within 3 years, like every member needs to go on into that pathway. That's something that, you know, the insurers and the ombudsmen and stuff, when we were dealing with them, that they recommended and was something as soon as I heard it, I was like, yeah, look, I agree. And I personally don't want any member feeling like they know enough at any point. Like, we can always do more. So, you know, this is something where, unlike the fitness industry, you know, and not to shit on it, but unlike the fitness industry where the minimum standards are cert 3 and 4, those who sort of like, if people hear this and like, oh man, I can't be fucked doing that. That's cool. Like, we don't want you. That's me being blunt, right? Because it's like, we don't want 100,000 members with a 30% to 40% turnover every 9 months, right? Like, we don't want that. We want 5 to 10,000 members nationally doing the right thing, leading by example with sustainable, successful careers. And so what it means is that the people who value that, hey, our minimum standard's not the cert, the minimum standard is in fact this grad dip, means that, look, in 4 to 5 years' time, we will have an industry that we're all proud of being a part of and a profession that we're proud of being a part of. And that's more important for like people like myself and Kyle. And this is why we're doing these things. And, you know, like, and we get to, you know, have these cool link ups with people like yourself, Brendan, as well, and like spread the message.
That's wicked, man. I reckon you guys have done a good job. So if you're out there, if you're listening, you're in the industry, you want to be in sports nutrition, or you're a trainer who's giving nutrition advice, don't be a dog. Go get certified. I'll chuck the links in the show notes. I'll chuck the links into the bodybuilding prep workshop. But Alex, Kyle, thanks for being on, guys.
Thanks, man. It was awesome.
All right, that wraps up episode 44 of the Perth Fit Fam podcast. So thank you for Alex and Kyle for being on. I hope you guys enjoyed that. They had some really insightful information. And what to look out for if you are either looking at giving nutrition advice or receiving nutrition advice and just helping to regulate the quality and control of the industry in general, which I think is awesome. So if you did like the podcast, please make sure to head onto iTunes, give us a 5-star review and leave a comment. We love to see that. And we also love to see reposts of screenshots on your Instagram stories. And we love to give them a reshare too. And again, if you love Perth Fit Fam, you love our content, you want to see more behind the scenes footage, how I put together clips, social media, fitness, everything, then make sure to jump onto Facebook and become a supporter and you will gain exclusive access to this content. But that wraps us up. I hope you enjoyed it. Episode 44 of the Perth Fit Fam podcast, done.